Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications. Today, Karen Briere of The Western Producer looks at the issue of carbon taxes on the prairies.
I don't get the sense that they're feeling the heat. The province seems to have really dug in its heels.
Lorraine Stevenson of the Manitoba Cooperator reports on a study that quantifies the value of community pastures.
Well, it pegged the annual average value of ecosystem services from community pastures at just over $13 million.
And Bruce Burnett of Glacier Markets Farm deciphers developments in trade and the markets. That's all on Between the Rows with this week's host, Ed White.
Hello and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm Ed White, your host this week. Today we're going to talk about the environmental impact of community pastures and the perplexing situation of international trade in the age of Donald Trump. But first, we're going to take a look at the confusing state of provincial carbon taxes on the prairies. Karen Briere of The Western Producer joins us now to describe the situation in Saskatchewan, which has a new premier, but not necessarily a new carbon tax policy. Hello, Karen, and welcome to Between the Rows.
Thank you for having me.
So, Karen, I understand new Premier Scott Moe and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau met and talked about carbon pricing. Did they miraculously resolve this issue, which has been pitting the province against the federal government for years now?
Well, the short answer is no, they did not. They met and discussed what Saskatchewan is already doing, according to the Premier, practicing zero till and things like that. And basically, I think I could say they agreed to disagree at this point.
And I understand Ralph Goodale, who is really the godfather of Saskatchewan federal Liberal politics, was part of the meeting. What role did he play there?
Well, he spoke to reporters after the meeting. The Prime Minister did not. And while he said that he wouldn't tell the province what to do, he did offer some suggestions of how it could work within the federal plan. So he talked about using carbon tax revenue to permanently reduce property tax on farmland. And he talked about rewarding farmers for practicing zero till, saying that they could be rewarded for that or provided an incentive to do more of that. And he offered other suggestions, such as reducing income tax or PST or cutting royalties for junior oil and gas companies, things like that that might make a carbon tax more palatable in the province.
What's your sense of who's feeling more pressure on them to come to some sort of an agreement? Is it the federal Liberals or Ralph, in Saskatchewan? Or is it the provincial government feeling the heat to get something worked out here?
I don't get the sense that they're feeling the heat. The province seems to have really dug in its heels. It is seeking a legal opinion, as far as we're aware, on perhaps taking the federal government to court over this issue. So as you know, Manitoba looked at that and decided it wasn't in their best interest to do that, so they're going to go ahead with the tax. But Saskatchewan just seems really entrenched in its position. And of course, Premier Moe was the environment minister when all of this issue started. So he is on the same page as former Premier Bradwell for sure.
And what happens if there's no deal, if there's no compromise?
Well, we've been told the federal government will impose the tax. And I guess that's the point where we will learn if the province will take the federal government to court. They haven't really said where they're at with that. The NDP opposition last week in question period asked about what the plan was, noting that Manitoba spent $40,000 on a legal opinion. And the exact quote from opposition leader Ryan Miley is this government about to embark on a costly crusade, a pointless crusade? But the province didn't bite. They just said they're still evaluating the situation.
Manitoba's got a bit of a situation like that too, although it's a bit different. Manitoba is, of course, and you know this has come up with its, quote, made in Manitoba solution. And is different than what the federal government has been demanding. It starts at $25 a ton and just stays there, whereas the federal government is requiring people to scale up to 50. And what happens if the province doesn't back away from not meeting that requirement kind of remains to be seen here.
Do you think Ottawa will let Manitoba do that?
That is the million, well, much more than $1 million question, isn't it? I mean, I don't think anyone really knows who's bluffing and who's going to be more obstinate and stiff-necked about this. The Premier, Brian Pallister, is a pretty stubborn guy. When he takes something on as an issue and a principle, he doesn't seem to be too willing to back away from it. And yet the federal government has obviously been pretty strong on this, saying that it has certain requirements and those have got to be met. So, I mean, here there's, you know, we have a number of Liberal MPs representing Manitoba, and Jim Carr is one of the most senior ministers in the government. So perhaps that's a bridge that could find some sort of a solution, but I don't know. I don't know if anyone sees who's going to blink and who's going to dodge. So, but I guess you and I will continue to cover this for the foreseeable future, right?
Yes, Saskatchewan is consulting still on its Made in Saskatchewan strategy that they call Prairie Resilience, and I believe they intend to consult as long as possible before a decision is made.
And of course, Alberta has its own completely unique approach, which is it's already embraced the carbon tax idea years ago and is not like Saskatchewan and not like Manitoba, right?
Right, yes.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Karen.
You're welcome.
Karen Briere is a reporter with The Western Producer. This is Between the Rows. I'm Ed White, your host this week. When it comes to the environment, there's lots of talk about carbon taxes. There isn't much talk about community pastures, but maybe there should be. Lorraine Stevenson of the Manitoba Cooperator has been looking at the value of community pastures and joins us now to fill us in. Hi, Lorraine, and welcome to Between the Rows.
Hi, Ed.
A lot of people barely know community pastures exist, and I guess if you don't have cattle, you might not have much reason to know. But you've been looking at some research that suggests there's a lot of environmental value to community pastures. Can you tell us a bit about this research and who did it?
Sure. This is a study just released by the Association of Manitoba Community Pastures. That's the producer-led not-for-profit organization that now manages 20 community pastures throughout the province. They cover about 141,000 hectares, which are mostly provincial crown lands. The AMCP worked with the International Institute for Sustainable Development to figure out the ecological goods and service values, or the direct monetary and non-monetary benefits derived from these landscapes.
And what are their big findings? What are they recommending coming out of this?
Well, it pegged the annual average value of ecosystem services from community pastures at just over $13 million, and actually quite a bit higher than that some years. A good part of that value, as we'd expect, relates to grazing services and the forage supply for livestock producers, about 350. Graze about 40,000 head on them every year. The forage supply alone from these sites is worth $5.67 million. But the benefits go well beyond the agricultural sector. Right behind that, it identifies what it calls a regulating service from these unbroken tracts of grassland in the way that they sequester a whole lot of carbon. The study valued that at worth $4.7 million. And it just goes on from there. Recreation and heritage and scientific research benefits was valued at $1.2 million. That's a number that's related to community pastures being used for for research, wildlife studies, for hunting, cultural practices, etc. Soil conservation and habitat for species at risk, another value of pegged at $825,000. And last but certainly not least, the study says these pastures generate over $860,000 in local economic development through the employment they're creating in rural Manitoba. The AMCP has nearly 40 employees who look after the cattle rotations and range management, etc., on these sites. As far as recommendations go, this study certainly says these sites must be maintained. A key recommendation is that there be a continued or even an enhanced focus on the management systems related to ecological goods and services on these sites, such as rotational grazing. And I think very importantly, the study tells us what would be lost if the community pastures no longer existed or those management practices were not employed. As you pointed out, it also notes that we don't really understand this very well yet. So it recommends sharing these findings with not just cattle producers, but with the environmental sector and the public at large.
The study says that there are all these different beneficial impacts in various areas because of grazing on these community pastures. But how is it that grazers, the animals, the grass, and the soil is actually producing these good effects?
Well, I think what we're just beginning to understand is that grazing has an environmental benefit. Unbroken tracts of land sequester carbon. These are sites where soil is conserved. Biodiversity is really critical. This research has basically begun, it has opened up a talking point for us to understand the relationship between a well-managed grazing site and the environment.
And what did you find most interesting here when you were going through this study?
Well, I think it reminds us how community pastures were a policy response in a time of crisis, and they continue to be. We're now facing some pretty critical times, again, as far as climate change goes. So this really points to how relevant these sites remain, and the study underscores how the benefits derived from these sites also clearly outweigh the costs of maintaining them.
It's interesting research. What can it be used for?
Well, it will be an important tool for the AMCP to attract potentially new funding sources and possibly start new projects such as carbon storage initiatives as the province moves forward to achieve its conservation and climate change mitigation goals. And as we've been saying, it's also a way for communicating to the broader public why unbroken tracts of grasslands are important and why it's important to keep them intact and managed in the way that they are.
Well, thanks for joining us today, Lorraine.
You're welcome.
Lorraine Stevenson is a reporter with the Manitoba Cooperator. This is Between the Rows. I'm Ed White. U.S. President Donald Trump knows how to keep things interesting on the trade front. He's taken a run at NAFTA, he's attacked steel and aluminum imports, and he's trying to start a trade war with China. That's having a bunch of impacts on crop and meat markets, and Bruce Burnett of Glacier Markets Farm joins us now to describe how this is all affecting the prices that farmers see for their crops and livestock. Hello, Bruce, and welcome to Between the Rows.
Good to be here.
Well, Bruce, it seems like every day Donald Trump wakes up, gets on Twitter, and stirs up the world. What kind of market effects is he having right now, and what are Canadian farmers seeing happen to their prices because of this?
Well, it's really been interesting because, quite frankly, the prices have not moved around all that much in response to this trade action that we've been seeing. Of course, when he announced the trade war with China, or looking to impose some duties on Chinese goods. There was a downturn in the soybean market at that point in time, but it's recovered since then. So really, there's been no big impact in the global markets from a commodity point of view. And I think that's mostly because the markets have determined this is maybe a little bit more bluster than actual activity that's going to happen. When we see activity happen where there are impositions of tariffs, then certainly that does impact prices. The current example right now is U.S. sorghum. The U.S. instituted some tariffs on essentially solar panels earlier this year, and the Chinese have now put sorghum imports into China under further investigation for dumping. So that's impacted the sorghum prices, but really the other commodities have not been affected to a great extent right now, certainly not compared to, let's say, the drought in South America.
I guess pork is the one that seems to have the clearest, because maybe I think are people anticipating the Chinese might actually do something on pork when they might not on something they rely on more, which is the soybeans.
Yeah, again, this is the potential target that the U.S. would be faced with if they go through with implementing the aluminum and steel tariffs from China. So this would be the Chinese response. That did push the hog prices down considerably. Again, it's hard to tell because the hog situation is one where we've seen some oversupply already. Markets were headed downwards before this was announced. I don't know if it was all in anticipation of losing China as an import market. Again, if you look at U.S. pork exports, China's not as large a customer as, let's say, Mexico or even Canada. So it's down the list in terms of the overall pork supply and demand balance, at least anyway.
Yeah, I was talking to Dermot Hayes of Iowa State University, an agricultural economist, and he was noting how the United States is actually a bit more insulated from this than Canada would be, because the Americans haven't cleaned out ractopamine from their pork system. And so they're less reliant on the Chinese market than we are. So with them, they just haven't become as wholehearted exporters to China as we have been. So they're sort of winning in a way for being slow on something that we were very aggressive with.
Yes, and you're going to see this, I think, as we get down further on into this venture that President Trump's taking us down, where we're going to look, and the devil will be in a lot of the details here in terms of who's the market that they're going after, and what sort of nuances there are in the global trade of things. Again, with pork trade, we'll probably see a drop in U.S. exports. Maybe a gain for Canada in that circumstance, could be a gain for Brazil or some other suppliers in the international market. So it's a very dynamic situation there.
I guess the good news on a Canadian side, especially a southern Manitoba side, is there's such a weanling export industry here to Iowa. And I was asking Dermot Hayes about whether this would challenge Canadian weanling sales to Iowa. Would people not be as aggressive in filling their barns with Canadian weanlings? And he didn't think so. He thought people are still making enough money that they'll just keep filling their barns. This is right now, it's a minor factor. So luckily for us, this isn't a disaster with people having piglets with no homes to go to.
Yes, I think longer term, and again, are these tariffs going to be short term, long term? Is it a negotiation issue or not? Or a long term trade strategy? If we were looking at longer term tariffs, I think you'd probably see Canadian pork trade change somewhat, where we would be finishing more hogs north of the border here, exporting them to China, and then likely importing more U.S. meat products, pork products in particular as well. So again, with trade, it's always a very dynamic situation, not very clear cut.
And with soybeans, there's a lot of speculation about how hard the Chinese could stick it to the United States, considering they buy so much? They obviously have some leverage there, but they also need it. What's your take on how far the Chinese could go in playing with U.S. soybeans to have a bit of a reprisal?
Well, certainly, if you talk to any U.S. analyst, they'll come out with the statement that they need our soybean imports. And I think that's true to some extent. The Chinese going to import probably close to 100 million tons of soybeans this year. More of it will be from South America, even though they've had some weather issues there, than from North America, and specifically the U.S. But over the entire season, they do need to have strong imports of U.S. soybeans. So we're likely not to see that change. What I would anticipate the Chinese to do, and again, if this is just a temporary short-term thing, it won't be a big impact. But longer term, if they do decide that they want to decrease the reliance on U.S. imports, they probably look at some seasonal tariffs or some import quotas of U.S. soybeans that would help promote more production in Brazil, more production in other countries. The other thing that they could also do is maybe diversify some of their protein meal. The ideal meal is soybean meal. So, but certainly other things like field peas and even canola meal can be used as a substitute. So you might see that trade increase as well. But that would be over the long term. You'd have to see that happen because right here, right now, they can't stop importing U.S. Soybeans just because it's not going to be economically advantageous for them to do so.
And I'm wondering, Bruce, just in general, dealing with some of the stuff coming out of the Trump administration, which can be kind of belligerent and blustery and done sometimes through Twitter, it's hard for a lot of people to know quite how to take this stuff. And there seems to be a divide between people who think that Trump is sort of an unthinking, ignorant populist who just goes with his gut, whatever he's thinking and feeling, you know, in the morning that day. And then there are those who feel that he's much more actually a man of some core principles and has a clear set of priorities and is actually executing on those in his own way, which is to sow disarray out there, and that it actually might be, at least in his own mind, an effective strategy. Which way do you see him?
Well, certainly components of this are the art of the deal. You know, this is Donald Trump's negotiating tactic. I think if you look in history, he has been very strong on trade and trade deficits. Now, from an economic point of view, that's probably misplaced. Trade deficits really are caused mostly by the fact that the U.S. does not save very much money internally, but that's fine. He holds these beliefs, and his trade team right now, specifically Lifthizer, Wilbur Ross, Peter Navarro, are all very strongly convinced that China is a problem in the world marketplace and that they need to bring some leverage to bear to change that situation. Now, you can disagree with the tactics, but I think virtually all of the free trading markets out there would like to see China open up a little bit more to give them a little bit better visibility on the internal workings in that country. But, you know, again, it's more tactics or philosophy here. They are looking at something that they've certainly Trump himself has viewed as a problem here for a decade or more.
And I was wondering the other day, you know, Trump has been quite belligerent and strong on NAFTA and the NAFTA renegotiations. And I was wondering, once the Chinese situation arose, if his actions on China had in fact, or on NAFTA were a way of signaling to China that he was going to be serious on trade. And now that he started the fight with China finally, maybe he'll back off a bit on NAFTA. What's your take on that?
Well, again, I think trade deficit drives this, and he views the deficit with Mexico and I guess his purported deficit with Canada. You can never really tell the numbers when he talks about them, but obviously, even though we enjoy a small trade surplus on goods and services, Trump is convinced that Canada is as difficult as well as a trading partner. So I think, again, this is part of a negotiating tactic. And certainly if we see tariffs on aluminum and steel at the end of May deadline, that's, again, a part of the pressure point that he has in trying to get these deals to go through. So I think this is more a negotiating tactic, but I think he's also very aware that we are important trading partners, and this is more trying to get the U.S. into a more favorable agreement than anything else.
Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see how this all tweets out. So thanks very much for joining us today, Bruce.
Thank you.
Bruce Burnett is Director of Weather and Markets Information with Glacier Markets Farm. That's all we have time for today. Good luck with your pre-seeding preparations, and tune in next week for another episode of Between the Rows.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.